3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 14.
At length the day came for my return to Melbourne, and we made an early start, crossing by ferry for the last time to the airport at Cambridge. Then the goodbyes, oh, so full of gratitude on my part, and up into the clouds from which I should descend to the ordinary doings of my everyday life. But there was yet another adventure ahead. We dropped down at Western Junction to take on passengers and mail from Launceston, and I was interested to hear the volley of farewells and laughter which marked the loading and departure of the airship. I was sitting well to the front of the plane, and shortly after we got up into the air, the hostess came to me and said, "Would you like to change your seat?" I said, "No, but that I would if it were desired." I was willing to move. She remarked, "I have a nice place for you down here," and undoing my safety belt, assisted me to get up out of the depths of my luxurious chair. Soon I was belted into another, just as comfortable, and was immediately saluted by a touch on the arm, and my neighbour said, "Aren't you Tilly Aston, the poetess?" "Why, yes," I said. "You don't know me, but I am Marshall Sumner." Often had I listened to his skilled piano work over the air, and I remembered then that he had been touring Tasmania with Signor Borgioli. Of course I was pleased to meet him. He told me that while at the conservatorium with George Findlay, he had often seen lyrics of mine which George had set to music, and that he knew me by sight as well. Next he introduced me to the great Italian tenor and his wife, who were sitting on the other side of me. We had a very enjoyable trip across the strait, recalling the night many years before when I heard the Signor in opera with Melba, and talking of Italy, where I had some correspondents living and working for the blind. Marshall Sumner had asked the hostess to bring me along to sit with them, and he kept me posted as to the sights. The floor of snowy cloud over which we flew for a time, the toy ships on the water a mile or two below, the gradual rising of the mainland into view, and the island dots beaded onto its most southerly point. This was indeed an agreeable finish to my trip to the beautiful island of Tasman. I was among the stars, as Fred put it in his next letter, in more senses than one. I came back, as on the occasion of other visits, full of enthusiasm for our neighbour state. Its fine river estuary, its natural wonders, its gorges, lakes, mountains and forests, all right at one's doorstep. We'll always have a magnetic pull on those who have been there before. Perhaps these gems of landscape beauty may not be pattern sites for big business, but they will call their lovers to walk among them and find there the God that walked in Eden and the peace begotten of innocence and quiet. The boy pianist. One very delightful afternoon, I can remember, was one on which, just before his departure for England, Noel Mewton Wood paid me a visit, in company with his mother. Sometime prior to that date, my book, Songs of Light, had gone into circulation, and a copy of it had been given to Noel as a Christmas present. I knew of this gift through the friend who had bought the book for him, but the fact had escaped my memory. However, one morning I received a phone call, and a lady's voice asked if I would be at home in the afternoon, as Noel Mewton Wood and his mother would like to pay me a visit. Of course I would be most happy to have them. In due time the visitors arrived. I found Noel, a well-grown boy of 13, cheerful and friendly and without any of that self-consciousness which hampers and restrains most boys of that age. Mrs. Mewton Wood told me that my lyrics had greatly pleased the young musician, and that he had set several of them to music. Noel joined in on the conversation, and wanted to know whether I liked music, as I did poetry. I owned up to a warm love in this direction, so he offered to play for me. Considering the poor quality of my piano I had at that time, the dear boy entertained me with his beautiful best. Then I asked if I might hear the songs he had set to my verse. Our songs, and his mother sang them to me, while Noel played the accompaniments. They were quite remarkable for so young a composer, although I dare say that Noel will not have so high an opinion of them now, at his more advanced stage of attainments. We chatted about them, and my youthful guest wanted to know what made me think of the ideas in my poems, where they were written, and under what circumstances. And I indulged him with one or two of my little secrets on the subjects, and tried to make him absorb the impressions which had inspired me at the time of writing. I was much surprised that a gay, light-hearted lad should fancy the lines "Spirit of Night" for a musical setting. This short song embodied a vivid impression gathered on a moonlight night in my sister's garden at Carisbrook, amid the warm country silence, somewhat ghostly in feeling, and it should have been the last thing to appeal to a child in his teens. But Noel liked to hear of its origin, highly delighted that he had captured the solemnity, the inexplicable mystery which had held my mind on that quiet night. Next, he wanted to know about the mechanics of my work. How did I actually put my thoughts on paper? And these inquiries led us to my study, to see my Braille machine and my typewriter. I wrote him a sample letter in each system, which he took away as a souvenir. I explained how all my work first went down in the Braille system, from which I afterwards copied it on the typewriter. After my demonstration, Noel asked to try the Braille machine, and in a minute or two he was trying his hand at writing his own name in our precious dots, and asking a host of intelligent questions about the invention, its originator, and it spread through the world of the blind. He roguishly congratulated all blind schoolboys on their immunity from blots. Perhaps he had some experience behind him in that. With the instincts of a teacher, I thoroughly relished holding forth to such a good listener, and before we had tea, he had also tapped out a few lines on my portable typewriter, just for the fun of it. Mrs. Mewton Wood and her son left me with the promise that I should have copies of our songs, and before they went overseas, that promise was redeemed. And I have the manuscript as a memento of that very happy hour we spent together. Since then, I have heard Noel playing for the BBC in London, and there are frequent accounts of his success from the musical world, although the incidents of the war must be holding him back considerably. When I met him as a boy, I felt he was destined for fame, and I await the day, war ended, when he shall reach his full height as a virtuoso, and perhaps a new composer of importance. War and its clouds. During my lifetime, our nation has had to face the sorrows of several wars. I was still a child when the Sudan campaign was fought, and the death of Gordon of Khartoum is just a faint memory. Then came the Boer War, and our pride in the exploits of our Australian light horse upon the African veldt. But the reality of wars, death, and destruction did not dawn upon me fully, perhaps, because of the fact that none of my family had reached the age for active service. But when the First World War broke over us, it was a different matter. Six of my nephews volunteered, two Alts from the home of my eldest sister at Durham Ox, two Lintons, sons of my sister Sophia, at Carisbrook, and two sons of my brother Will. We were proud to be so well represented, and sent our boys off with comparatively light hearts, and with our blessing and good hopes for their return, crowned with the glory and honours of ultimate victory. I was engaged in my school all through that war, and had little time for any special war work. However, we got the children knitting, even a few of the boys learning to turn out a passable sock, as well as washers and scarves and other articles which needed but slight supervision. My own contribution was a pair of socks a week for the whole period of the conflict. Then shadows dimmed the bright outlook concerning our nephews. Edwin Alt and Will Linton were posted as missing. Most terrible announcement of all for those who wait the return of a soldier. My sisters could not accept this as final, and they searched and searched for something more definite, hoping, dreaming, praying, longing. that the lost ones would somehow, somewhere be found and restored to their homes again. Amelia, Mrs. Ault, never settled down, never accepted the fact that her son was dead. She would write letters to any man of whom she heard that he had been in Edwin's battalion, bidding him to brush up his memory in case some trifling spark of recollection of her own lad might be rekindled. As I recall this fruitless agony of my sister, my heart overflows with pity for the thousands of women who are receiving the same bitter word, missing, concerning their beloved soldiers of this present war. Not until years after the war had ended did anything more definite come to hand. A man who escaped the Holocaust of the landing day on Gallipoli saw Edwin surrounded by about a dozen Turks, madly laying about him with his trenching tool. It is a foregone conclusion that he died in that hour. Of Will Linton, we also heard the end in due time. Victor Ault met at a soldier's reunion a man who had been with Will in the ship as it lay off Gallipoli a few weeks after the first landing, and he said the boat in which the company was being thrust ashore was shelled and sunk, and that our young kinsman was one of those who did not reach the beach, but was drowned in the blue Aegean Sea. The story of Arthur was another affair. He was in the 12th Field Ambulance, on service in France. When I was on a cruise up north, I met a gentleman who had been a member of Arthur's unit, and he gave me some particulars about him. My nephew had been sharing in the conduct and production of the regimental paper, and had written some very lively articles for the magazine. Before his enlistment, he had begun to do little freelance jobs, and showed more than usual promise in this field. The blow came in an action near Ypres. I think that was where it was. They were bringing in the wounded, and a shell exploded far too near. He died of his injuries next morning, sending loving messages of triumphant courage to his father and mother, which were forwarded in a letter from his superior officer. He was buried in one of the war cemeteries in France, the only one of our three lost boys who has a known grave. Whenever I visited the Shrine of Remembrance here, I feel that this beautiful and solemn edifice belongs to me, since it is the place where I can grow pensive, thinking of my kinsmen and their sacrifices for me and the other women of Australia. And Tilly acknowledges this in a poem. A woman to the shrine, with acknowledgments to the woman's world. One quenched in depth of blue Aegean Sea, the other broken, mingled with the sod of ancient sunlit far Gallipoli. The mortal perished, and their souls with God. No graves are theirs, where I may softly tread and cast a wistful glance or drop a tear. I cannot plant a garden o'er my dead or claim a sacred spot to memory dear. Yet on a hill that breasts our sunny skies with crowning dome and stately portals wide, the shrine upon its lap of verdure lies in memory of our sons who fought and died. These founding rocks, these pillars set apart, these storied marbles in their sombre sheen, all that sunk stone, the temple's very heart, what do this lordly fane and altar mean? No piled-up vanity of human skill, no waste of wealth, since workmen built the walls, only a place where love may linger still, a pensive wanderer in its echoing halls. And there may I and other women go, for pause to think upon our loved and lost. This holy spot, the only grave we know, of those who bought our peace at such a cost. And that was written on Anzac Day, 1936. Writing in the spring of 1944, I am conscious that the present war has affected me less poignantly in a personal way. Perhaps I am happier in my individual life than I was at the time of the last upheaval. Or it may be that with added years I have a better perspective of values. Then the new generation of my family has been reared, in most cases outside the inner circle of my contacts, for they have lived in the country, or else too deeply absorbed in the pursuits of youth to spare much time for great auntie. Nearly a dozen of them have answered the call to the services, both boys and girls, and are scattered all over the war front in Army, Navy, and Air Force. So far, none have made the supreme sacrifice, but they are all doing their duty to the nation. Meanwhile, at home, I have taken up the one war job of which I am capable now, knitting and getting others to knit. Some of our blind folk have gone forth into general industry to lend a hand in the manpower problem and are doing surprisingly well in very unexpected places. But for a woman of my years, any such course was out of the question, so I took up work for the Red Cross almost from the commencement of the strife. I know that other blind women were anxious to help too, and I got in touch with headquarters, and through the officers there was put on the scent of a good supply of wool for my band of knitters. At first, Mr. Neal at the Tweedside Woolen Mills offered to let us have some wool, which had been donated to the Red Cross by the Recreation Club of that firm. For a long time, this supply was unfailing, and the splendid parcels of work went forward in the joint names of the Mill Club and the Blind Women of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind. Then the introduction of rationing put a stop to this bountiful supply of knitting yarn, and I went once more to headquarters. The late Mrs. Geoffrey Wood was in charge then, and she asked me if we could possibly undertake the unripping of misfits and get the wool worked up into satisfactory garments. Miss Bradford, who stands by me in all such enterprises, offered to help, and we began to receive great parcels of queer-looking articles in knitwear, which we unripped, skeined, and washed the wool, and prepared it for knitting, and then distributed it to the workers. In this way, we have salvaged nearly £300 worth of wool, besides relieving the Red Cross of one of its little problems, and I am very proud to record that the goods we sent back are received with complete satisfaction by the staff, and the acknowledgements are always accompanied by a note of commendation. This special job, though insignificant in itself, uses up a lot of time, but it will go on as long as there is bad knitting to recondition. Often I get some fun out of it as well. Extraordinary at times are the garments we get, doubtless coming from children or from sadly inexperienced knitters. Imagine a pullover for a gentleman, 64 inches round the bust, gloves with fingers 6 inches long, balaclavas large enough to hold two heads, or the reverse, just big enough for a toddler's bonnet. One day I had a couple of Air Force boys to visit me, just when a consignment arrived from headquarters, so we had a dress rehearsal, and it did us all good to share the uproarious mirth of the lads. It's good to laugh in these hard times, even if it is at the expense of having to knit over pounds and pounds of wool through the errors and mishaps of some young or old dear, and every comfortable garment I make or get made by blind friends brings a glow of pleasure at its completion, since there is a hope that it will also bring a physical glow to some dear soldier in the front line, or to one suffering in hospital or in prison camp afar. And now I want to grow confidential with the readers by telling them something of the letter friends I have had in the forces. For in this way I have had many little thrills. First among them is Brigadier S.H. Porter, whom I knew before he enlisted. He went away with the rank of Major right at the beginning of the war, fought through the Syrian campaign, and was wounded by a sniper somewhere near Lebanon. Later he was swept back to this homeland of his, just to pass on to New Guinea after a weekend with his wife and small son. Then he led his men over the Owen Stanley Range, and on to that victorious end, gaining promotion all the way, which was added to the DSO won in Syria. Whenever he could find time, he sent me a friendly letter, always interesting, assuring me of his continued remembrance of his blind friend at Windsor. Being an outstanding leader of men, he has had plenty of experience in training and building up the reinforcements, and for a time was on administration work, doing something in Papua towards the restoration of the country. I know he would enjoy this, for he was eloquent in the praise of the Fuzzy-Wuzzy, and the services rendered by the native race to the men of the services. Another highly appreciated correspondent was my cousin Colonel Jack Herbertson, DSO, now Director of Water Transport for the mainland and Northern Islands of Australia. He was an artillery officer and well into the African campaign and its desert fighting. He is just a trifle proud of being a Tobruk rat, and one of his letters to me was written while he was blockaded there in the siege. He also spent a good deal of time in Palestine and can talk for hours of the historic places of the Bible, of the communal farms, of the Jewish settlers, of the great monastery where he lodged for a time, and of Jerusalem, Nazareth, Tiberias, and of the new Zionist city of Tel Aviv. Many people travel and see things, but not all can write or talk intelligently of what they have seen. Cousin Jack is not of the unseeing eye, and his letters made me think how fortunate I had been in my correspondence. I had a third soldier friend who was a good letter writer. This was Lance Corporal T.H. Merritt of Western Australia, introduced to me as a correspondent by our mutual friend, Flying Officer C.E. Kerville. Mr. Merritt was not personally acquainted with me, never having met me before he went overseas. Our exchange of letters lasted for several years. At first he wrote from Palestine, from whence he sent me a souvenir of the Bethlehem shellcutter's work in the form of a pendant. Just about the time I received it, we had a record broadcast of this industry going on in the Bethlehem markets, and I wondered if it were my pendant being made at the time of the recording. Mr. Merritt was struck down in Greece with grievous wounds and wrote from there as soon as he was able. Next, he was taken to a prison camp in Germany and was able still to get an occasional card through to me by the channels of the Red Cross. In this camp were some of the blinded men of whom the Marquis of Normandy proved to be a veritable godfather. And my letter friend, who had some association with the work, gave me a first-hand account of the efforts made to begin the rehabilitation of these handicapped men. Finally, Lance Corporal Merritt was among those prisoners of war exchanged towards the end of 1943 and was repatriated to Australia, came to Melbourne for a course of plastic surgery, and we met for the first time. During my life, I have often indulged in friendly correspondence with people whom I never expected to meet in the flesh, and always I have conceived a mental picture of such persons, not so much of the physical parts, face, form, and figure, but of the mental and spiritual qualities, likely to be revealed on closer acquaintance at meeting, and of the voice and demeanour resulting from the general character of the unknown. Now, here was an opportunity of testing my estimate of a fellow being from his letters, and I was more than interested to find how correct it had been. Mr. Merritt's talk was as good as his letters, and, whatever he may feel about his Melbourne Marianne, as any lady correspondent of a soldier is called in the French army, his Marianne congratulates herself on having had such luck with him as with my two other principal correspondents in the forces. And a poem on this subject by Tilly. The Widow. The storm had passed, the lightning sword was sheathed, the drumming thunders that had racked her soul were still, and on my breast she softly breathed the sorrow now to be her lifelong dole. So young, so sweet to walk the world alone, fair as a summer cloud and formed to rise on loving wings of lightest zephyr blown, the happy child of ever-shining skies. The clouds of dark Papua, where he fought and died, the glory of her life have quenched. Of all her precious dreams there lingers naught but battered hopes and memories sorrow-drenched. "Without my love," she whispered, "joy is dead." I pressed her hand and kissed her shining hair. No word of comfort was there to be said, only my mother instinct's silent prayer. For years have made me wise and taught me much, how time assuages grief and smothers woe, soothing each throbbing wound with healing touch, and I am glad, since God ordains it so. Upon this tortured heart I dare not press, this wisdom I have won, she too must wait, and win her garden from the wilderness, left by the raging storm within her gate.
That brings us to the end of episode 14 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.